Welcome back to Alternative Realities. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. On previous episodes, we've discussed the muted return outlook for traditional 60/40 portfolio and the return enhancing potential of private equity and venture capital. As companies wait longer to IPO, investors are turning to private markets for access to the fastest growing part of a business's life cycle. Today, we're going to explore the opportunities in private healthcare and biotechnology in particular. To do so, I'm joined by my colleague, Gaurav Gupta, Managing Director of Life Science Private Capital within JP Morgan Alternatives. He's a neurosurgeon turned investor, and we're so excited to have him here to discuss the trends he's seeing in the market. So Gaurav, welcome to Alternative Realities.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So before we dive into sort of specific issues with regard to your sector, can you tell me a little bit more about your background and the areas of healthcare that you've typically invested in?
Yeah, of course. Well, I started my career taking care of patients. I'm a neurosurgeon by training. Used to obviously operate on very sick patients, operate on their brains and spines. I left the medical field when I had the opportunity to begin my career as a biotechnology-focused investor. What I typically focus on is early-stage companies developing novel therapeutic medicines. So that can be anything from a pill you take by a mouth to an antibody therapy you take through an injection or an infusion, all the way up through something like an mRNA product like we saw with the COVID vaccines. And so that's where I focus my time exclusively now, is on thinking about investing in, you know, the most exciting companies that have, you know, new medicines and new types of medicines for diseases where there's still a lot of unmet need.
And so thinking about sort of just healthcare more broadly from an investment perspective, what are sort of the biggest areas of growth that you can see going forward from here?
In the pharmaceutical sector, we have a very interesting dynamic that we has really become cemented in the last, you know, decade plus, where the large pharmaceutical companies have sort of moved away from developing novel medicines to really focusing on commercializing them. And I bring this up because that forces them to then look to the innovative small biotech industry for new medicines, you know, as their existing medicines hit patent cliffs. I bring that up to answer your question, because where do we see the most interest and development of novel types of medicines? I think it breaks down broadly to about four or five different themes. You know, the first one, and I know we're going to spend some more time talking about this, but what I would broadly call the bucket of cardio and metabolic diseases, and that includes the obesity medications, which, you know, beyond just being one of the most important trends in healthcare, is, you know, a global mega trend, I think, on par to the early days of the internet almost. I mean, the kinds of things that are really changed not only our healthcare system, but have profound impacts on society and public health writ large. A second area is, of course, oncology, new cancer medications. Cancer is a scourge that affects all of us. And, you know, the development, we've had multiple major breakthroughs in cancer treatment in the last several years. I think, you know, I really expect that to continue. I'm very optimistic about what we're seeing there. And it's an area of focus for us to invest. A third major area is autoimmune disease. So these are common diseases like Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, rheumatoid arthritis. We have seen really tremendous breakthroughs in the treatment of some of these disorders and expect a lot of innovation there, particularly in the next decade and beyond. Neurologic disorders, meaning Alzheimer's and Parkinson's in particular. And in Alzheimer's, we just had a couple of landmark new drugs for the treatment of Alzheimer's for the first time ever, which I'm happy to talk about. Expect to see more there. And then a final and more of a technology theme is genetic medicine. So I mentioned the mRNA vaccines for COVID earlier. That was a type of genetic medicine. But the use of genetic medicines to treat broader populations is going to be profoundly impactful. We just had the first ever approval of a CRISPR gene-edited product. That was in December of 2023. That was for the treatment of a disease called sickle cell anemia. Now, that's a pretty rare disorder, but, you know, that tool moving into the treatment of broader disorders for people, I think, is a really exciting technology theme. So it's a really incredible time in the biopharma sector. There are so many major breakthroughs happening almost, you know, yearly. We come across a major new advance in a disease that when I was a physician, The textbook answer is that this is a fatal, incurable disease, and now we are seeing medicines that prolong and extend and even cure some of these diseases. It's really an exciting time to be in this sector.
I'd love to talk with you for a long time about all of this. I mean, just reading the story of CRISPR, it's just a fascinating story. It's just
10 years from discovery to an approved product. I mean, there's never been a story like that in our space. So.
And the sort of the nature of the fix that you're actually able to manipulate to splice DNA using that, it's amazing. But anyway, we can't talk about all of those things. And really, we are trying. This is a kind of an investment podcast. So I did want to talk about. You talked about the big pharmaceutical companies, and you talked about these amazing innovations in these smaller niche areas. But should investors think differently about how they would invest in private healthcare versus public healthcare?
I think they definitely should. For a couple of different reasons. But let's start with the private side, because that's where we spend our time. You know, we built our team to really leverage the significant drug development expertise that my partner and our colleagues all bring to the table, because this is a very difficult business. You know, when we do start clinical trials, we as an industry face quite long odds. Less than 1 in 12 drugs that start clinical testing end up being approved at the FDA. Now, in our prior careers as investors and drug developers, we have significantly outperform that, thankfully. But I think it takes a lot of specialist know-how. So I think for private investments in biopharma companies, I strongly encourage people to look at, you know, specialist managers. I think that level of expertise is really critical to appropriately de-risk those investments. Not that you're de-risking them completely, but that the millions of little decisions a company needs to make as they're designing a drug and taking it through phase 1 testing, phase 2 testing, and beyond, to be able to bring the expertise that a team like ours can bring, I think is invaluable. So with private markets investments, I would strongly encourage partnering with an expert manager who lives and breathes these kinds of things. Now, public markets are, of course, different. You know, there's a lot of different ways to get access to the public markets. The one thing I'll say about biotech in the public markets is that it can be hard to fight the tide. You know, there are years in which the XBI, our tracking index, has, you know, shown that small and mid-cap public biotech companies have been an excellent space to be investing in. And there's years, like unfortunately the last several, where it's shown that it's been a difficult space, no matter how good you are at picking names or picking companies that the prevailing ones. You know, and biotech in the public markets, it's an exquisitely rate-sensitive asset class. It is a long-duration asset class. These companies are still years away from generating revenue. That their NPV of their product is sort of discounted based on protected future cash flows, of course. So there are other headwinds, I think, in the public sector where, I think it boils down to choosing a great manager to work with. But I think that the skill sets of the managers end up being very different.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it sounds like in the private equity part of this, you really need to know the nuts and bolts of how to get a drug from idea to actual approval, and you have to know all the hurdles that you have to jump through very well to understand that.
We really try to help our company solve problems. You know, when they are facing an issue, we hope to have the network of people, individuals that can drop in and solve that problem, or an outside resource, whether it's a consultant or an outsourcing partner that can fix that problem for them, so that there's no delays, so that, you know, we stay on timeline and on budget, that we get the right help we need to fix a problem. We are very active with our companies and try to help them look around the corner all the time.
So Gaurav, activity in private equity has been pretty muted, as you know, because of higher interest rates. Is that the same story in healthcare, and how has that impacted valuations?
Yeah, well, you know, we're very lucky. We just earlier this year announced that we raised a fresh $500 million pool of capital to take advantage of this moment. I mean, to your point, you know, it has been a slowdown with the slowdown of the IPO market. That sort of recycling of capital into the sector has been slower. We see this for us as a really attractive entry point in a very target-rich environment. our view is that the long-term fundamentals of this sector, including some of the ones I mentioned earlier, the rapid pace of innovation, the types of technologies we're seeing, the fact that the secular driver of returns in our sector is pharmaceutical companies needing to acquire innovation as they hit patent cliffs. And we are facing some of the largest patent cliffs in the history of the industry by the end of this decade. So there will be an impetus for these companies to look to the sector, the space that we invest in, to replenish those pipelines. We're optimistic on those fundamentals. And so, you know, I won't necessarily say that we can predict better than anybody else. Is that, you know, is that reversal coming next year, 26, 27, or 28? But by being able to deploy in this investment period now, we think we'll be well positioned to you know, buck that trend that you just alluded to, which is that, you know, money goes in the ground and stays there for a while.
You know, another question just very much specific to biotechnology is AI. And there's a lot of attention about how AI could be used to accelerate drug development. How real do you think that is?
This is such an important topic and one we've spent a tremendous amount of time, effort, resources to really try to understand. You know, we do have the benefit of, across our team, a really broad swath of drug development expertise, but we're not computer scientists. So, you know, as it comes to evaluating the specific models and data sets, we've taken the view that what we want to do is look at the output of certain discovery approaches that leverage AI and machine learning, and then try to evaluate those products. Our view has been in the first iteration of these companies, which spans maybe going back 3 to 5 years, whether it was the techniques or some of the lack of that multidisciplinary approach that is required anytime you integrate two fields like medicinal chemistry or biologics, protein engineering with AI and machine learning. Some of the drugs we were seeing come out of those companies, in our opinion, were not up to snuff. And so we were cautious on that first generation of AI companies. I recently had the privilege of attending, you know, a collection of the top minds in this space. We all got together for a dinner. This included, you know, the CEOs of probably the top 10 to 15 venture-backed AI drug discovery companies, several representatives from large pharma. We had representatives from big tech companies. We had top medicinal chemists. It was really, you know, an illuminating and long and deep discussion. Where I think the field is today at this moment, one, on the sense of the AI company, there is a bit more humility about what they think that they're going to be able to bring to the space, but also a little bit more clarity. You know, I think that what we are likely to start to see is the onset of companies that can use these models with high quality data to maybe start to make predictions about the likelihood a molecule may have a certain toxicity, or that it may have a certain issue in early clinical testing that's a safety issue. That could be extremely valuable. I would say if we step back to a higher level of abstraction, though, in the broad sense of where the cost and time in drug development is, it is in the clinical trials. You know, the building a molecule from, you know, initiation to getting it into your first patient, there are generally some boundary conditions on how long that should take and how costly it should be. And if you speed it up, it's an objectively a good thing. And I think that there are going to be companies that can speed that up, just as we've democratized a lot of the tools in that space over the last 10 years. And, you know, frankly, at this point, a well-funded company could almost run virtually and outsource its entire drug discovery paradigm. And we've seen a couple examples of that successfully. But at the end of the day, the bulk of the cost, the bulk of the time in drug development goes into clinical trials. What I'd love to see is companies that start to leverage the tools and the toolbox of AI and machine learning to start to think about, how do we turn that towards precision medicine? As exciting as it is, we're just a few days here past the Nobel Prize being awarded to the discoverers of AlphaFold, which is a brilliant technology that allows us to predict structure based on sequence and then begin to predict how small molecule drugs could bind, and has been leveraged, you know, broadly across the industry. It is a game-changing innovation. It's a brilliant step forward. But what I would love to see is those kinds of approaches applied to thinking about selecting patients. You know, one example that my partner, Dr. Steve Squidko, gives is, you know, one of the drugs that he developed in his career, when he took it into a group of patients that had a genetic marker for their disease, meaning he could pre-select them to be likely to respond to his drug. He ran a trial that had a 100% complete response rate. So when you think about being able to select a patient in that way, whether you use genetics, whether you use some signal in their RNA signature, protein signature, something you might see at an MRI, if you can select patients and do in a more precise way, put them on your medicine, then you can run a smaller, faster trial. And then I think we will start to see real impacts in terms of getting drugs to patients faster and approved faster. So I'm optimistic on it. We're very optimistic on it. We're learning as much as we can. And I think in summary, AI is going to be everywhere, all around us. It'll be like breathing. I don't think that any field anywhere will avoid it or not see significant impacts of it. I just think that we're waiting to see a company, and hopefully we will see one soon, that allows us to really save time and cost in clinical development. I think that could be, you know, a very exciting area for the next gen of AI to start building tools.
Well, if we could move from the exciting frontier of AI to the boring backwater of politics, we do have an election coming up, and
of course.
Potential regulatory changes. How are you thinking about that, and any risks that could come from that?
There are. I mean, you know, in our industry, we have to be very attentive to what's happening in Washington. Not only the unfortunate rhetoric, you know, it strikes me that the pharmaceutical industry can be so demonized. And it was only just a few years ago that we had this whirlwind development of, again, mRNA vaccines, monoclonal antibodies. You know, and I would have wished that that would have led people to understand that the investments that have been made in the innovation engine underlying biopharma are worth it for society, and that, you know, that they go somewhere. But unfortunately, we seem to have moved into an era where there's a little bit of a whipping boy dynamic, and that's, you know, perhaps not likely to change. So we have to remain attentive to what's happening in Washington. In general, you know, the price negotiation policies that were implemented as part of the Inflation Reduction Act have been very, very modest in terms of their overall impact, and expect them to continue to be. If there were a outcome of an electoral process such that, you know, it seemed likely legislation would be passed that significantly expanded those, I think that could have an impact, and that it could start to really dent, equally importantly to, you know, our investors and the returns we generate, it could start to really dent our ability to innovate in this country. And I think that's the scary, you know, maybe the ultimately scary thing about that kind of legislation. The question of whether that kind of outcome is likely, you know, we across the two branches of government, which it would need to be, as we saw, you know, when the Inflation Reduction Act was passed, I wouldn't dare to prognosticate or prophesize today, but I think the most likely outcomes that I would expect would be sort of split control, so that there's not, you know, the White House and both chambers controlled by one party. In that case, the status quo with our sector, which is to say the biopharmaceutical sector can continue to innovate and bring innovative new medicines forward. So that should be a minimal impact.
All right. So I guess what you're worried about here, and then I suppose a longer list, but what are you excited about here? Where do you see the best opportunities?
Investment opportunities.
Yeah, exactly. Best investment.
Absolutely.
There's a lot more to talk about in medical opportunities, but investment.
Yeah, no, of course. Yes. Well, look, you know, I think just stepping back to a comment I made earlier about obesity as a market being a global megatrend. I have the privilege in my seat of traveling the world and meeting with, you know, my counterparts in the pharmaceutical business. I can share with you that in every meeting room I've been in any city in the world, on any continent, the obesity drugs have really been topic number one. The obesity business, obviously Lilly and Novo have, you know, really benefited from multiple expansion and share price appreciation. Eli Lilly is now, I believe, the seventh largest company in the world, having surpassed Tesla. I believe Novo Nordisk just surpassed JP Morgan to be either 12th or 13th by market cap. Novo Nordisk is the largest company by market cap in Europe now. Its market cap actually surpasses the GDP of Denmark in some countries. So these are really meaningful, you know, value creation franchises for these two companies. But why is that? I mean, you know, if you just again try to comp this to the kind of business that these represent, the consensus sell side projections for those two drugs, Ozempic and Zepbound, consensus sell side estimates are about $150 billion annual sales. I just want to remind everyone that Google Search, which is considered by many to be the best business of all time, did $164 billion last year. So, or maybe that was 2 years ago now. But we're talking about a pharmaceutical business that stands toe-to-toe with one of the best technology businesses ever created. Now, we don't have the same margins. We do have very good margins in the pharmaceutical business, but it's not Google Search. So these are highly valuable enterprises. And what's very clear about the obesity market is also that if you look at the history of the pharmaceutical industry, it is often the case that the first to market medicines are not the ones that become the best in class, right? The dynamic that we have in our sector is that every doctor, every patient, every insurance company, they want to be on the best in class drug, right? That has the best features, the best clinical data, the best outcome, the best tolerability. So it's a winner take all type dynamic in drug development when the, you know, people want to reach for the same drug every time that has the best possible outcome. When you look at the two drugs that we talk about here, they are fantastic medicines. Just to be very clear, patients benefit tremendously from them. Not only do they lose weight, but their blood sugar improves, their blood pressure. It's a life-saving medication for a lot of these patients, in my opinion. We know that the rate of heart attack and strokes go down even in non-diabetic patients, which is tremendous. So life-saving, I think, is an appropriate terminology. But they do have some drawbacks. You know, they are weekly injectable products. It's recommended that they be refrigerated between injection. That somewhat limits them to a bit of a higher technically proficient, maybe socioeconomically, you know, privileged group of patients. And then, of course, what's widely appreciated, of course, is they about half the weight loss, total body weight loss, is lean muscle. And, you know, it's not clear yet that there's medical sequela from that we can point to, I would say. Some people in our space would point to it. But what's very clear is that that fact and the product format start to dictate what kind of patient's really benefiting. It tends to be patients that can handle the logistics of a weekly injectable drug. And with the muscle loss component, if you just think about a 200-pound man who needs to lose weight, goes to his doctor requirement for the drugs, the doctor would say, well, on the maximal dose of these drugs, the data would tell me that you will lose 20 pounds of muscle. For most men, David, I think you might agree, I'd be curious, but I think that's a non-starter. I mean, you know, for most men, they endeavor to put on muscle mass. So we are seeing, you know, a product class hitting 150 billion that is not yet penetrating, I think, all segments of the market, not even close to it. So the future of that market is tremendously exciting. And I really think at this point, we can feel pretty good about the development of drugs that will come to the market that are oral pills you can take via mouth, put in a medicine cabinet, take with you, that are just much more broadly applicable than a weekly injectable drug. Longer acting injectables that could be given once a month or maybe once a quarter, which would be, again, more attractive to many, many patients. And then ideally those kinds of medicines that also specifically isolate the fat loss while allowing preservation of the lean muscle. Mm-hmm. So it is a tremendously exciting opportunity. If you think about the business case for that kind of medicine, I think we view this as, you know, the best investment thesis that we've ever seen in the biopharma industry. And what's also exciting about it is the large pharma companies are really playing catch up. You know, they have to really come forward and try to stand toe to toe now with the tremendous success that Lilly and Novo have had. Mm-hmm. So, you know, going back to that kind of dynamic that I mentioned to you earlier, we see a lot of opportunity in the space. It is competitive. There are over 260 trials right now of obesity medications. But
it sounds so interesting. I mean, there's certainly so many opportunities to improve human health, but also lots of investment opportunities and lots of places where investor capital can be put to really good use. So thank you, Gaurav, for joining us on Alternative Realities, and we'd love to have you back sometime.
Oh, such a pleasure. I'd love to be back. Thank you for having me.
This content is intended for information only, based on assumptions and current market conditions, and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.